It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a policy expert tells us about the 50% funding cut proposed for public transportation in the state's two biggest cities. First, President Biden met with Russian President Vladimir Putin earlier today in Geneva. President Biden said his goals were clear: to stabilize the relationship between Russia and the U.S.
President Putin and I had share a unique responsibility to manage the relationship between two powerful and proud countries. A relationship that has to be stable and predictable.
It's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. We'll check out that Biden-Putin meeting to start, plus the latest on infrastructure negotiations, voting laws, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the president's trip abroad and the G7 summit? What do you want to see when it comes to a relationship between the U.S. and Russia? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill. Reed, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, fresh news today with this Biden-Putin meeting. They each held their own press conferences after. A lot of people looking into the symbolism of how they did things and what they said. Bar was pretty low, as I'm hearing in the news. What do you make of what came out of this so far?
Well, this looked like another sort of reset meeting that every administration tries to do with Russia, or at least every administration in the post-Cold War era, the Vladimir Putin era, has tried to hold with Russia. President Biden was aiming to deliver some pretty substantial messages to Vladimir Putin. I don't think there were very high expectations in what either side hoped to get out of this. It was notable that President Putin came out of the meeting talking positively about President Biden and the messages he'd received. They both sort of hinted at the tensions that still exist over things like cybersecurity threats and the human rights record that Russia's sort of abysmal human rights record. The President Biden seemed to offer some almost veiled threats. I mean, at one point he said that he'd told President Putin, you know, how would you feel if your cyber infrastructure were attacked? Which sure sounded to me like, boy, that's a nice cyber infrastructure there. Would be a shame if anything happened to it.
Now, looking at this through the lens of American politics, obviously a lot of domestic issues, a lot of domestic priorities for the Biden administration still in the works. We're going to be spending a lot of our time talking about those. Reed, what do you make of this step out to the international stage while all this is going on at home?
This is almost the area where President Biden is more comfortable than he is in the domestic side. Remember, he spent a long time as chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. One of his big pitches during the Democratic primary back in 2020 was that when he got to the world stage, he wouldn't have to be introduced to a lot of world leaders because he knows them and has these relationships. He tried to demonstrate that over the weekend at both the G7 summit in the UK and then a NATO meeting in Brussels. And I mean, this is where President Biden knows probably more about foreign policy, American foreign policy in the Cold War and post-Cold War era than almost any other politician alive. So this is his bread and butter. And he seemed more comfortable on that international stage than he does at times on the domestic stage.
We're going to talk more about the U.S. and Russia tomorrow on the show. Right now, it's The Week in Washington. Reed Wilson is with us, national correspondent at The Hill, looking at some big stories coming up, infrastructure and voting rights laws. You can join in with your thoughts and questions on those topics right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Perennial negotiations on infrastructure spending continue. What do you want to see happen? Do you want to see federal voting rights legislation that's supported by many, but not all, Democrats to pass? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lot of threads, Reed, when it comes to infrastructure negotiations. I want to start with one of them and give a listen to West Virginia Senator Republican Shelley Moore Capito on the infrastructure package. Here's Senator Capito talking to Fox News.
I am extremely disappointed because we offered the president basically what he asked us to do the first time we met with him, which was $1 trillion over 8 years, including baseline spending, and that it wouldn't include a tax increase. And that was our red line, not his. And the last offer that I got from the president had 4 tax increases in it.
So that's Reid, one of the threads that kind of wrapped up negotiations between Capito and some other Republicans directly with the White House. So who are we watching now trying to scramble to come up with some kind of infrastructure plan?
Well, I always joke that Capitol Hill is rife with gang activity. So the Shelley Moore Capito gang has been sidelined for the moment. And now the White House is talking to the Bill Cassidy gang. He's a Republican from Louisiana. Also, members like Mike Braun from Indiana, some other members there. Susan Collins, of course, in the middle of that Republican mix. And it looks like this latest offer that at least 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats have agreed to would increase spending by about $1.2 trillion over the next 8 years. About $600 billion of that is new spending. The other $600 is, you know, money that gets sort of shuffled around. And this is something that it looked as if there was an opening for, but that opening closed pretty quickly when the progressive senators like Bernie Sanders of Vermont, Jeff Merkley of Oregon, Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut came out and said they couldn't vote for a bill like this because it doesn't address climate change issues to their satisfaction. That makes the effort to get to the 60 vote threshold that you need to advance a bill all the more difficult because now that Democrats would have to win over 13 Republican votes instead of just 10. And remember, they started with only 5 in that group of 10 bipartisan senators negotiating. So it's difficult to see how they get there at this point. Now we've seen Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer say today that he's going to hold a special conference meeting with his Senate Democrats to start talking about going bigger and going alone. And that would mean using what's called the reconciliation process, which is a process that would only require 51 votes to advance. And of course, Democrats have 50 votes in the Senate plus Vice President Kamala Harris to break any ties. That's a little touchy, though, because some of the centrist politicians like Shelley Moore Capito's seatmate Joe Manchin, Senator Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, have voiced some concerns about doing that sort of go-it-alone approach. We'll see if something gets done. We've got, 2.5 weeks until the July 4th recess. Usually the way Congress works, in my experience, is that nothing happens up until the very last possible minute when everything gets jammed through real fast. So we'll see what Congress thinks is the real last minute. Is that right before the July 4th recess? Is it right before the August recess where they're gone for a longer period of time? Infrastructure talks, though, they've been more sort of stop and go traffic, if you will, to keep on the infrastructure theme.
You mentioned the concerns about climate provisions from progressive Democrats. Here's Massachusetts Senator Edward Markey speaking here on Friday on that issue.
We can't have an infrastructure bill in 2021 that doesn't have climate at its center. And any other bill that we are going to consider that does not have aggressive solutions to the climate crisis will just have that response, which I've been giving, which is no climate, no deal.
No climate, no deal, Reid. That's just one of many stumbling blocks on this thing.
Yeah, and this brings up the notion that, you know, in a caucus of 50 votes, when they're, you know, in a 100 member body, in a 50 vote majority, there are 50 majority leaders. Everybody gets to be that deciding vote. And that, of course, makes everything more complicated when you're trying to figure out how to get to the 50 votes and keep all of, you know, herd all of the cats, if you will, which is a difficult thing to do under normal circumstances, and even more difficult in this political environment. And when you're talking about a 1.2 or more trillion dollar bill.
Reid, everybody seems to agree that they want something on infrastructure. I mean, going back to former President Trump's first days in office, this is the one thing that Trump and Democrats were going to be able to work together on. Here we are. He's out. Next guy is in. And still nobody's agreeing on an infrastructure deal. Is this just a never-ending story? Do you see any kind of resolution coming?
You know, there's an old saying in Washington that infrastructure is the last bipartisan area of agreement. I'm not sure that's true anymore because the two sides now define infrastructure so differently. I mean, Republicans see infrastructure as, you know, roads, bridges, and ports. Democrats see infrastructure much broader. They want to include conversations about rural broadband and, the infrastructure of families and climate, for that matter, which is obviously something that Republicans have never been terribly willing to talk about in a big bill like this. So, the old trope was that everybody's for infrastructure because that means everybody gets something for their own district. It was no accident that the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee was always the biggest committee in the House of Representatives. Everybody wanted to be on it because everybody wanted a bridge named after them in their own district. Nowadays, that's not really the case anymore. You know, blame the death of earmarks, blame the hyper-partisanship, or blame this very fundamental difference in how the two sides, define the word infrastructure. But the fact is, the old areas of agreement, they're just not working anymore.
Talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill. He's helping us break down the news from Washington. Coming up, voting rights laws. A lot of states making changes, some making things tougher in some ways to vote, things like absentee ballot restrictions, some states loosening things up. Democrats saying they need to pass something at the national level. Also running into roadblocks, and not just from Republicans. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Congress pass a voting rights bill that would maybe make it harder for states to restrict access to voting? Do you not want to see that happen? Should things be left to states? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Reed Wilson, national correspondent with The Hill. And we're looking at some of the top stories in national politics coming up. Voting rights. Should Congress pass something? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we've got this going on at the national level, Reed. I know you focus a lot on what's going on in states, though. And I want to start here with this review, is what some people are calling it, of the voting, the presidential voting in Arizona's biggest county. A lot of Republican lawmakers, including some from Wisconsin, going there, and one, I believe, Reed Wilson went there to check it out. What did you see?
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. So what has happened is the Arizona State Senate, which is run by a pretty hardcore faction of Republicans, has demanded an audit of Maricopa County's votes, almost 2.1 million votes cast in the 2020 election. President Biden won Maricopa County by about 45,000 votes. He won the state of Arizona by about 10,000 votes, and becoming the first Democrat since Bill Clinton to carry the state's electoral votes. President Trump has pushed the lie that there was malfeasance in the election, and to try to prove that, these Arizona state senators have demanded a recount in the face of loud objections from the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, which is a 4-1 Republican majority, and the Maricopa County Recorder, who is a Republican who actually won election in the very 2020 election that the state Senate wants to look into. And it's a real bizarre scene. It's not something that we've ever seen before. Post-election audits are common, and as a matter of fact, every state and every county audits their elections afterwards before they certify the election results to make sure nothing went wrong. Well, Arizona and Maricopa County audited their own elections, decided that nothing went wrong, but the state Senate is not willing to do that. Instead of hiring an auditor with any experience in auditing elections, they hired a Florida company called Cyber Ninjas, a cyber defense company, the cybersecurity company that, again, has no experience auditing elections and also was involved in pushing some of the false rumors about widespread violations. And what I was seeing in Arizona is more and more Republicans getting really anxious about what this audit was doing to their own brand and to their own hopes of winning back elections in 2022 or 2024. You know, one of the things that we've seen in the post-election sort of weeks and months is that Republicans are in pushing the lie that there was voter fraud in the election, they are undermining confidence in the election among their own voters. One of the big reasons that the two Georgia senators won, the Georgia Democrats won in that January runoff, is because a lot of Republicans decided not to vote, not to show up to cast ballots in an election they didn't believe in. So I was talking to a couple of state senators down there. The state House Majority Leader basically rolled his eyes when I asked him about the audit. He said, look, there's a reason that we haven't been involved in that. It's only the state Senate and only these hardliners. Now that the count has finished up, they haven't issued any report, which makes me think that they didn't find anything to actually report. But they are still engaged in this really bizarre exercise in examining the very paper on which the ballots were cast. There was a rumor going around a while ago that they were looking for, and I say a rumor on the floor, this was actually reported in the Arizona Republic and some other places, that they were looking for things like bamboo within the ballot because of rumors that there had been ballots flown in from South Korea or China. Just these bizarre conspiracy theories that have taken over. And one of the things that is intriguing, you know, it's not just legislators from Wisconsin who are coming to watch. I found legislators from 10 states, all Republicans across the country who are going to Arizona to check this out. And in a couple of cases, they have returned to their home states calling for audits of their own elections. So you might imagine that some of the Republican legislators who went down from Wisconsin last week might come back and start calling for audits of votes in Wisconsin. Now, once again, I think it's important to remind everybody, audits are completely common when they're conducted by people who actually know how to audit an election. In the Maricopa case, that's just not what's happening.
That's just one state. Democratic lawmakers in Texas walked out to stop a vote on election changes there. A similar story is going on around the country. So that has eyes on Congress, Reed. What are Democrats trying to do when it comes to voting bills? What kind of stumbling blocks have they hit?
So Democrats have passed two bills through the House. One is called the For the People Act. The other is called the John Lewis Act. They are different approaches to overhauling the nation's elections. And they're running into challenges from those very Democrats that we talked about on the infrastructure bill, specifically Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, who's not willing to nuke the filibuster or anything like that in order to pass these voting rights. Just a few hours ago, Manchin released a list of electoral changes that he would be willing to vote for. And that may begin the process of some kind of conversation among Democrats. However, it looks increasingly unlikely that the Dems are going to be able to get to the 60 votes they need in the Senate because they're not going to find a lot of Republicans who are willing to go along with this. This goes back to sort of a 10th Amendment issue here. You know, we don't have one central administrator of elections in the United States. We're unique in the sort of Western free democracy world in that we have 51 different election administrators in our states and the District of Columbia. And as a matter of fact, in a state like Wisconsin, you've got, gosh, something like 3,000 different electoral authorities, whether it's towns or counties or cities or anything like that, who actually run the elections. And in all these different states, there are all these different rules that govern how easy it is to get access to the ballot. So Republicans will say, look, this is an issue that the states are better equipped to handle in terms of their own rules and procedures for voting. The Democrats will say, wait a second, we need to have a national standard for how easy it is to vote and how these votes are conducted. And the fact is, that's an argument that is almost impossible to bridge simply because they come from such different starting places.
Talking to Reed Wilson from The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national news. Reed, I want to take a look now, again, back at the 2020 elections, emails coming out from between the elections and Inauguration Day from the president's team to Department of Justice officials looking to put pressure on and pursue some claims of fraud. What did we learn?
these are pretty remarkable. So the Trump administration was pressuring the Justice Department to effectively come up with evidence for fraud that would undermine confidence in the integrity of the election. Let's remind ourselves, this came after the Trump administration officials themselves called the election the most safe, most secure elections ever conducted in American history. This, you know, all what the Trump administration was doing in its final days was trying to undermine the very notion that he might have lost an election that he very clearly lost by a very wide margin in states like Wisconsin, by wider margins than he won 4 years previously. So this is more evidence of troubling behavior by the Trump administration. We haven't seen a lot of efforts by Democrats in Congress to conduct the oversight that they might have had Trump remained in office. And that's raising some concerns among good government types who wonder, you know, whether or not by allowing this behavior to go unchecked and undisclosed, whether or not we're opening ourselves up for, the next time.
And Attorney General Merrick Garland now runs that Department of Justice. Has he responded to this pressure on his predecessors?
Yeah, there is an open investigation now in Congress, at least. It looks like some Democrats in Congress are going to hold hearings into this. Merrick Garland The Justice Department official who oversees the division that would have sort of made him aware of this has resigned. It's not clear to me whether that was Merrick Garland firing him or not, or if this guy was just resigning at the end of what was anticipated to be the end of his tenure. But at least one head has rolled in the Justice Department. And you can imagine some pressure on the Justice Department to get to the bottom of this, especially after 4 years in which the White House acted like the Justice Department was the president's personal legal team. Now we've got a new president who has picked an attorney general who he wants to be independent and has been independent enough that it has actually caused headaches for the White House. You know, how is this White House going to bring the pressure to bear on their own attorney general when they've said they want their own attorney general to be independent?
Reed, in just our last half a minute or so, a lot going on. Obviously, what is the big story you're watching for in the following week?
Whether or not we can get an actual infrastructure bill done, whether Joe Manchin's list of demands on voting rights are going to actually pan out into any kind of agreement. Congress always seems to back up into the very last corner and pass everything they possibly can at the last minute. When is that last minute? Is it right before the July 4th recess or right before the August recess?
Reed, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill. He joined us for a weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Now, the state legislature's budget committee passed a plan last week that would cut public transit funding in Madison and Milwaukee by 50% over the next 2 years. Republicans said they voted for the funding cuts since the state's receiving millions of dollars in federal coronavirus aid. All Democrats on the committee voted against the funding cuts. The ACLU says the funding cut discriminates against those who are unable to afford cars or unable to drive. We're looking at public transit in Wisconsin, and not just in the state's two biggest cities. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the cut to public transit funding proposed in Madison and Milwaukee? Do you use public transportation of some sort in your community, big or small? Do you feel like you need more of it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rob Henken is president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He's co-author of the group's recent report on public transit called The Wheels on the Bus. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Can you talk about the impact, if it ends up in the final budget, of these funding cuts for public transit in Madison, Milwaukee?
So that sounds like an easy question where I could just, give you a dollar amount and describe the impact. The reason it's not an easy question, and one of the rationales for the cut, of course, is because there are these federal dollars, most recently under the American Rescue Plan Act, that have given both of these transit systems just a huge influx of aid at a time that they badly need it. These dollars can be used through September of 2024. So one of the reasons this is a difficult question to answer is you'd sort of need to know the plan for allocating those dollars over the next few years. You'd have to prognosticate what's going to happen with ridership over these couple of years. Critical to recognize that one of the reasons that the federal government saw fit to give such a significant amount of aid to transit systems is that ridership has declined. As the economy has declined, as people have stayed home, et cetera, there are fewer people using mass transit. But there's also a desire not to have these transit systems cut their routes. So that's where the federal money comes into play. So it's a huge mix of ridership revenue, federal revenue, state revenue. Clearly, these state cuts would hurt. Whether they would hurt immediately is doubtful, again, because of the availability of these federal dollars. But for both the Madison transit system and the Milwaukee transit system, there are some deep structural problems. And so clearly, cuts of these magnitude of, you know, close to $40 million in each of the next 2 years for the Milwaukee County transit system and a smaller amount for Madison, about 30%, however, of its budget is state revenue. These cuts are going to hurt, if not next year, then certainly potentially in the years to come.
Can you talk about the role public transit can play in a local economy, whether it's those bigger systems in the bigger cities or some of the things we see in smaller or mid-sized communities?
Well, transit plays a vital role. And, you know, it depends on local economies. It depends on a lot of different factors. But clearly, there's a sizable portion of the population that depends on mass transit, if not to get to work every day, perhaps for people who are not working to get to doctor's appointments or to the grocery store. So it plays a role. You know, it's the irony is that when the economy is going well, transit ridership tends to drop because greater numbers of individuals may be able to afford to purchase automobiles, and so they stop taking the bus. We're not there yet. Our economy is clearly recovering, but I think it's still very early to tell exactly what the impacts are. You know, we both have the factor of what's going on with the economy and how many people have reentered the workforce. We also have these huge societal changes in terms of the way people are working. You know, so many more working from home. So there's all sorts of factors out there, but I don't think there's any question that to the extent that as a result of cuts in state funding, major transit systems, or really any transit systems across the state would have to cut service. That can not only reverberate in terms of people's quality of life, but also in terms of our economy and the ability of people to seek and to gain access to employment.
Talking to Rob Henken, president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, looking at public transportation in Wisconsin and funding for public transportation. A state legislative proposal would cut funding in Madison and Milwaukee, in part because there's a lot of federal money coming in to help those systems deal with the COVID emergency. You could join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you want public transportation funding to be a priority at the state level in your local community? Do you rely on public transportation yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rob, I mentioned that report that you and your colleagues did, Wheels on the Bus. You looked at six communities around the state to look at the COVID impact, Milwaukee and Madison, as well as Appleton, Janesville, Wausau, Stevens Point as well. What kind of things did you find, apart from the basic obvious point, less ridership?
Yeah, so one of the things that we did was we actually looked at what was going on pre-pandemic. And what we found, quite frankly, was pretty alarming. I think generally across the board for these transit systems, and we essentially use these six, which are a mix of small, medium-sized, and large transit systems, we were seeing declining ridership in most of them. And so, you know, why is that a problem? Well, it's a problem because each of these systems is reliant to some extent on ridership revenue. Now, your listeners may be thinking, well, okay, if not as many people are riding, then why not just cut service? And that can be a very difficult situation. Might there be an ability to cut some service? Yes. But at the same time, number one, if the decline in ridership is due to economic factors, we all know the economy is cyclical. And once you lose service, it's tough to get it back. And it's tough to really get it back in time to react to any economic change. The other thing is that by cutting service, are you simply entering this awful cycle where that's going to then result in a further decline in ridership, which is going to mean a further decline in passenger revenue. So assuming that these systems still want to keep service levels the same and passenger revenue is declining, then what are the options? Well, we have seen that state aids, which are very important to transit systems, have essentially been flat. That's been the same pre-pandemic with regard to federal. So increasingly, what we are seeing is local communities having to come up with greater local shares for transit budgets. And that itself has caused some issues, given all of the restrictions on the ability of local governments in Wisconsin to generate revenues. To the extent that they need to come up with more for transit, it may mean that they have to make cuts elsewhere.
That was pre-pandemic. How much did the pandemic then shake up that funding model?
So, you know, without question, we saw transit ridership plummet across the board far more than it had been trending prior. That, of course, was, during the height of the pandemic when we had the safer at home restrictions and people weren't leaving their homes. As the economy started to rebound and things started to open up, we saw some of the transit ridership rebound. But as of the time we wrote the report, most systems still were not even close to where they were pre-pandemic. Now, again, ordinarily, that would have been a huge problem. Here's where the influx of the federal dollars, first through the CARES Act, which was one of the first major pieces of federal legislation passed back in the spring of 2020, that provided enough money to virtually all transit systems across the state to be able to make up for that loss of passenger revenue and not have to reduce service. In addition, for many systems, Madison and Milwaukee included, there were sufficient dollars to actually roll some of those over to 2021 to help ease the impact of the fact that ridership still hadn't declined that year. We've then had two subsequent pieces of federal legislation that, depending on the size of the transit system, have again resulted in really big influxes of federal dollars. So for now, as we look just over the short term budgetarily, these transit systems are doing fine. The question is, how quickly are they going to spend down those federal dollars? And when those federal dollars are exhausted, what will the ridership picture look like? Will there still be a revenue gap there? And what will be the ability of their local government to continue that commitment of potentially increasing local dollars to support the existing routes?
We're talking about public transportation funding in the state with Rob Henken, president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of public transportation do you have in your community? Do you use it? Do you wish there was more of it? Or do you not see it as a top priority for state or federal or local funding? Call in at 800-642-1234. And does the availability of options to riding cars, whatever those might be, make a place more attractive for you when you're deciding where to live? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Wisconsin Policy Forum President Rob Henken about cuts to public transit funding in Madison, Milwaukee, proposed by the state legislature, and the outlook for public transportation in communities around the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you have in your community when it comes to public transit? What do you think you need? Have you relied on public transportation either recently or in the past? Or do you think it's a lower priority? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Well, I think my grandfather worked in the railroad, and I think one of the things about railroad transportation in northern Wisconsin anyway is you really have to be patient and build for the future. In Superior, we're building a hotel downtown, and the time's coming when we'll get light rail transit between Duluth Superior and the Twin Cities for commuters who want to travel that way. And I think it's part of our long-term plan to bring back that kind of train transportation. My ancestors had it throughout northern Wisconsin, from Spooner to Chippewa Falls and across to Green Bay. But, of course, that's gone. But it would be nice to have that federal funding and restore that type of transportation, in my opinion.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. And, Rob, we've been mostly talking about within a community or metropolitan area. Jeff's saying, hey, maybe some light rail to connect to a region, not just one local community.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, we have had big political fights about rail, certainly in southeast Wisconsin, going back 30 years now, but obviously a decade ago had a big political discussion about potentially having rail service between Milwaukee and Madison and a higher speed type of service. You know, I mean, I think that's one of the areas where, you know, transit funding and sort of thinking about the future have often been at conflict. We have seen during, you know, various good times and bad, different efforts to try to say that, you know, transit just isn't important and people would prefer to drive. And again, when the economy is going strong and more people are purchasing automobiles, sometimes we do see that declining transit ridership and people ask the question, well, why, you know, why shouldn't we be cutting state support, for example, to transit systems? Why should we be thinking about spending all sorts of capital dollars to bring back rail, et cetera? And so there are a couple of issues there. Number one, again, as I said earlier, things tend to be cyclical. And there is a portion of the population that does rely on transit, not just people who can't afford automobiles, but people who for a variety of reasons can't drive. And so, you know, there's sort of a rationale there. We have also found, you know, repeated surveys have been done showing that when if talent attraction and retention, particularly of young talent, is a priority in metro areas, then having good transportation is very important to that. And younger people do tend to value transit options, and in particular, high quality transit options, which are sometimes only achievable via rail. And so that can be a means of attracting and retaining talent. So there's all sorts of factors there. Unfortunately, this does require long-term planning. It requires long-term funding commitments. And that's just a step we haven't really been able to take across Wisconsin for many, many decades.
Go back to our callers now. David is with us in Ironwood. David, hi.
Yeah, I heard Kansas City went free transit and it increased the people going downtown. I mean, who would want to go downtown trying to find a place to park and stuff? But if you get on a bus, go down free and spend your money, I mean, and global warming, we want the people to get off cars off the road. I think maybe more cities should try that.
David, thanks for the call. I don't know about those Kansas City numbers, Rob, but that idea of making transit easier and even free, as David is pointing out, what do you think?
Well, actually, that's something that several transit systems across the country have experimented with in the wake of the pandemic and with the availability of these federal dollars to fill in for the ridership revenue that would be forsaken. And I think it's a very interesting experiment. End of the day, it would require a greater public subsidy in virtually all instances if that was to be something that would be a long-term situation. You know, the HOP, the new streetcar system, relatively new now streetcar system in Milwaukee has been free since its inception. And, you know, oftentimes it can be a great way to incentivize people to try transit. And then even when you do either reinstall or install some type of fares, you can still get folks to continue to ride it. And it's sort of a win-win situation. So I think it's an interesting experiment. I think it's one that, again, potentially is now more realistic than it's ever been, at least for the next year or two for some transit systems because of the availability of this federal money. But I do think that doing it over the long term would require a greater commitment of public dollars. And again, you know, we as an organization don't opine on issues like that. But clearly there are some who would, you know, be not real open to the idea of actually having to completely have public dollars support the what once was a farebox revenue share of mass transit.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Rob Henken with the Wisconsin Policy Forum, looking at public transportation in Wisconsin and funding for it. Some cuts on the way, at least in a legislative plan for Madison-Milwaukee. Cuts may be made up for by federal funding from various coronavirus relief packages. Rob, you mentioned making a place attractive for younger workers. And I know there's this new report out on trying to lure millennials to Milwaukee in particular. That's the topic of conversation, by the way, tomorrow morning at 7 on the morning show. Can you talk a little more about that angle of things, trying to bring those workers, maybe especially those younger workers, into a community with the lure of high quality, you mentioned, mass transit?
So, you know, it's a great question. And clearly, anecdotally, I mean, we ourselves did a survey of millennials 5-6 years ago. And clearly, that's one of the things you find when you survey is that, you know, good transportation, and in particular, good transportation options that don't involve, you know, having to own and operate a vehicle for oneself is seen to be of value. That said, then you get into the question, well, what is quality transportation? Are we talking about, well, sure, millennials will ride trains, but for whatever reason, they won't ride buses? Or does the mode not matter? What matters is the frequency with which the bus or train comes, that's referred to as headways, or the speed at which it can get one to its destination. Now, interestingly, despite this move so far by the legislature to cut state funding for Madison and Milwaukee, those are two transit systems that are looking at some big upgrades in the quality of transit. The Milwaukee County just broke ground a couple of weeks ago on a bus rapid transit system. Madison has plans for BRT in the works. That would be a higher quality of bus service that would be faster, that would be sleeker, that would have more conveniences. And so, you know, as with so many different types of economic development investments, it's difficult to know for sure. But if one believes the surveys, this is something that is valued. Again, the key question is, how do you translate that value into a return on investment? Because, again, making these investments in high quality transit does require some pretty sizable capital outlays.
And very briefly, we're talking mostly big cities. Your report also touches on the Bay Area in Ashland, Bayfield, Iron, and Price counties. There are various public transportation alternatives on a smaller scale in lots of non-big city communities, right?
Absolutely. And again, that's where we're talking about, you know, maybe the key goal there isn't attracting millennials, but it's making sure that seniors have a way who can no longer drive to get to doctor's appointments in the grocery store, et cetera. You know, it's maybe to connect people, you know, to certain employment centers and so forth. So I don't think there's any question. I mean, transit looks different in different parts of the state, but having some type of options available for citizens who, for whatever reason, don't own or operate, you know, single automobiles is something that is seen to be an essential public service.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thanks so much for having me.
That's Rob Henken, president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He joined us for a look at public transportation funding here in the state. His group, the Wisconsin Policy Forum, came out with a report on public transportation funding issues a couple of months back called Wheels on the Bus.